resisted framing an innocent man for murder. Not only did the recordings confirm Meyer's recantation, they exposed the lie that Pearson had told the court, the jury, and Mr. McMillan's trial counsel, that there were only two statements provided by Myers. In fact, Myers gave at least six additional statements to the police. They were all favorable to Walter McMillan, and none of them had been disclosed to Mr. McMillan's attorneys, as was required. I called on Mr. McMillan's trial lawyers, Bruce Boynton and J.L. Chestnut, to testify about how much more they could have done to win an acquittal, a not guilty verdict, if the state had turned over the evidence it had suppressed. We finished the presentation of our evidence, and to our surprise, the state put on no rebuttal case. I didn't know what they could have presented to deny our evidence, but I assumed they would present something. The judge seemed surprised, too. He paused, and then said he wanted the parties to submit written briefs arguing what ruling he should make. We had hoped for this, and I was relieved that the court would give us time to explain the significance of all the evidence in writing and assist him in preparing his order, an order I hoped would set Walter free. At the end of 3 days of intense litigation, Michael and I said our farewells to the family in the courtroom and left feeling exhausted but satisfied. Bay Minette, where the hearing took place, is about 30 minutes from the beautiful beaches on the Gulf of Mexico. We had started a tradition of bringing our staff down to the beach each September, and we'd all fallen in love with the clear, spectacular waters of the Gulf. Dolphins could be spotted in the early mornings, playfully making their way through the water. I'd often thought we should move our office to right there on the water. It was Michael's idea to hit the beach after the hearing before heading back to Montgomery. I wasn't sure it was a good idea, but the day was warm and the coast was so close, I couldn't resist. It would soon be dusk, but the heat persisted. I stood at the water's edge, my head racing with everything that had transpired in court. I replayed what witnesses had said and worried about whether things had gone exactly right. I analyzed every detail in my mind, every possible misstep until I caught myself. It was over. There was no point in making myself crazy by overthinking it now. On the sandy shore, I watched the brilliant white pelicans gliding effortlessly over the still waters in search of food. Walter would be making his way back to Holman now, shackled in the back of the van again. I thought about his family and all the people who had come to court. They'd kept the faith through the 5 years that had passed since Walter was first arrested. I thought about Mrs. Williams. She had come up to me after the hearings and had given me a sweet kiss on the cheek. I told her how happy I was she'd come back to court. She looked at me playfully. "Attorney Stevenson, you know I wasn't going to let these people keep me out." Her words made me smile. Michael got out of the water looking worried. "What did you see?" I joked. "Shark? Eel? Poisonous jellyfish? Stingray? Piranha?" He was out of breath. "They've threatened us, lied to us. There are people who have told us that some folks in the county are so unnerved by what we're doing they're going to kill us. What do you think they're going to do now that they know how much evidence we have to prove Walter's innocence?" I had given this some thought, too. Our opponents had done everything they could to frame Walter in order to kill him.
They'd lied to us and subverted the judicial process.
More than a few people had told us that they'd heard angry people in the community make threats on our lives because they believed we were trying to help a guilty murderer get off death row. "I don't know," I told Michael, "but we have to press on, man. We have to press on." We both sat there in silence, watching the sun fade into darkness. Chapter 10. Mitigation. America's prisons have become warehouses for the mentally ill. Mass incarceration has been largely fueled by misguided drug policy and excessive sentencing. But the internment of hundreds of thousands of poor and mentally ill people has been a driving force in achieving our record levels of imprisonment. It's created unprecedented problems. For over a century, Americans suffering from serious mental illness have been shifted between prisons and mental institutions. In the late 19th century, alarmed by inhumane treatment of mentally ill people in prison, Dorothea Dix and Reverend Lewis Dwight led a successful campaign to get mentally ill people out of prison. As a result, state mental hospitals started opening up to provide care for the mentally distressed. But by the middle of the 20th century, abuses within these mental hospitals began generating a lot of attention. Families, teachers, and courts were sending thousands of people to institutions for issues like resisting social, cultural, or sexual norms, not for acute mental illness. People who were gay, transgender, or engaged in interracial dating found themselves committed against their will. In the 1960s and 1970s, laws were enacted to prevent involuntary commitment. People with developmental disabilities were empowered to refuse treatment. Forced institutionalization became much less common. By the 1990s, several states had reduced the patient count in mental hospitals by more than 95%. While these reforms were desperately needed, the timing of them intersected with the spread of mass imprisonment policies, expanding criminal statutes and harsh sentencing, and the effects were disastrous. The free world became perilous for deinstitutionalized poor people suffering from serious mental disabilities, such as schizophrenia or psychosis. Disabled low-income people who could not afford to receive treatment or necessary medication were greatly at risk of a police encounter that would result in jail or prison time. Jail and prison had already become the state's strategy for dealing with a health crisis created by drug use and dependency. Now, on top of that, a flood of mentally ill people headed to prison for minor offenses and drug crimes, or simply for behaviors their communities were unwilling to tolerate. Today, over 50% of prison and jail inmates in the United States have a diagnosed mental illness. In fact, there are more than three times the number of seriously mentally ill individuals in jail or prison than in hospitals. In some states, that number is 10 times. And prison is a terrible place for someone with mental illness or a neurological disorder that prison guards are not trained to understand. For instance, when I still worked in Atlanta, our office sued Louisiana's notoriously rough Angola prison for refusing to modify a policy that required prisoners in segregation cells to place their hands through bars for handcuffing before officers entered to move them. Disabled prisoners with epilepsy and seizure disorders would sometimes need assistance while convulsing in their cells, and because they couldn't put their hands through the bars, guards would mace them or use fire extinguishers to subdue them. This intervention aggravated the health problems of the prisoners and sometimes resulted in death. Most prisons are overcrowded and don't have the capacity to provide care and treatment to the mentally ill. Without treatment, complying with the many rules of prison life is impossible for many disabled people. Other prisoners exploit or react violently to their behavioral symptoms. Frustrated prison staff frequently subject them to abusive punishment, solitary confinement, or the most extreme forms of detention. Many judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers do a poor job of recognizing the special needs of the mentally disabled, which leads to wrongful convictions, lengthier prison terms, and high rates of returns to prison after release. A lot of my clients on death row have had serious mental illnesses. For some, mental illness has developed in prison as a result of stress and trauma. But Avery Jenkins' letters, handwritten in print so small I needed a magnifying glass to read them, convinced me that he had been very ill for a long time. I looked up his case and began to piece together his story. It turned out he'd been convicted of the very disturbing and brutal murder of an older man. The multiple stab wounds inflicted on the victim strongly suggested mental illness, but the court records and files never referenced anything about Jenkins suffering from a disability. I thought I'd find out more by meeting him in person. When I pulled into the prison parking lot, I noticed a pickup truck there that looked like a shrine to the Old South. It was completely covered with disturbing bumper stickers, Confederate flag decals, and other troubling images about guns and Southern identity. One read, "If I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd have picked my own damn cotton." Despite growing up around images of the Confederate South and working in the Deep South for many years, I was pretty shaken by the symbols. I'd always been especially interested in the post-Reconstruction era of American history. My grandmother was the daughter of people who were enslaved. She was born in Virginia in the 1880s, after federal troops had been withdrawn and a reign of terror had begun, designed to deprive African Americans of any political or social rights. Her father told her stories about how the promise of freedom and equality following slavery ended immediately as white Southerners reclaimed their political power through violence. Recently emancipated black people were essentially re-enslaved by former Confederate officers and soldiers who used intimidation, lynching, and peonage, forced labor to pay off debts, to keep African Americans subordinate and marginalized. Terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan cloaked themselves in the symbols of the Confederate South to intimidate and victimize thousands of black people. For 100 years, any sign of black progress in the South could trigger a white reaction that included Confederate symbols and threats. In the 1950s and 1960s, civil rights activism and new federal laws inspired the same resistance to racial progress and once again led to a spike in the use of Confederate imagery. In fact, it was in the 1950s, after racial segregation in public schools was declared unconstitutional, in Brown v. Board of Education, that many Southern states erected Confederate flags atop their state government buildings. At a pretrial hearing, I once argued against the exclusion of African Americans from the jury pool. After presenting the data and making my argument about the unconstitutional exclusion of African Americans, the judge complained loudly. "I'm going to grant your motion, Mr. Stevenson, but I'll be honest. I'm pretty fed up with people always talking about minority rights, African Americans, Mexican Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans. When is someone going to come to my courtroom and protect the rights of Confederate Americans?" I wanted to ask if being born in the South or living in Alabama made me a Confederate American, but I thought better of it. I stopped in the prison yard to take a closer look at the truck, walking around it and reading the stickers and symbols of racial oppression. As I entered the prison, I was met by a correctional officer I'd never seen before. He was a white man of my height, about 6 feet tall, with a muscular build. He looked to be in his early 40s and wore a short military haircut. He was staring coldly at me with steel blue eyes. I walked toward the gate that led to the lobby of the visitation room, where I expected a routine pat-down before meeting Avery Jenkins in the visitation area. The officer stepped in front of me and blocked me from proceeding. "What are you doing?" he snarled. "I'm here for a legal visit," I replied. "It was scheduled earlier this week. The people in the warden's office have the papers." I smiled and spoke as politely as I could to diffuse the situation. "That's fine, that's fine. But you have to be searched first. You're going to go into that bathroom and take everything off if you expect to get into my prison." I was shocked, but spoke as nicely as I could. "Oh, no, sir. I think you might be confused. I'm an attorney. Lawyers don't have to get strip searched to come in for legal visits." Instead of calming him, this seemed to make him angrier. "Look, I don't know who you think you are, but you're not coming into my prison without complying with our security protocols. Now you can get into that bathroom and strip, or you can go back to wherever you came from." I'd had some difficult encounters with officers getting into prisons from time to time, mostly in small county jails or places where I'd never been before, but this was highly unusual. "I've been to this prison many times, and I've never been required to submit to a strip search. I don't think this is the procedure," I said more firmly. "Well, I don't know and don't care what other people do, but this is the protocol I use," he snapped. I had driven 2 hours for this visit and had a very tough schedule over the next 3 weeks. I wouldn't be able to get back to the prison any time soon if I didn't get in now. I went inside the bathroom and removed my clothes. The officer came in and gave me an unnecessarily aggressive search before mumbling that I was clear. I put my suit back on and walked out. "I'd like to get into the visitation room now," I tried to reclaim some dignity by speaking more forcefully. "Well, you have to go back and sign the book." He said it coolly, but he was clearly trying to provoke me. I'd already signed the attorney book. It would make no sense to sign a second book. "Lawyers don't have to sign that book. If you want to come into my prison, you'll sign the book." He seemed to be smirking now. I tried hard to keep my composure, turned around, and signed my name. I walked back to the visitation room and waited until the officer finally pulled out his keys to unlock the door. When he opened the door, I stepped forward, but he grabbed my arm to stop me. He lowered his voice as he spoke. "Hey, man, did you happen to see a truck out in the visitation yard with a lot of bumper stickers, flags, and a gun rack?" His face hardened. "I want you to know that's my truck." Then he released my arm and allowed me to walk inside the prison. I felt angry at the guard, but I was even more irritated by my own powerlessness. I was distracted from my thoughts when the back door of the visitation room opened and Mr. Jenkins was let in by another officer. Jenkins was a short, African-American man with close-cropped hair. He grasped my hand with both of his and smiled broadly as he sat down. He seemed unusually happy to see me. "Mr. Jenkins, my name is Brian Stevenson. I'm the attorney you spoke—" "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake?" He spoke quickly. "I'm sorry, what did you say?" He kept grinning. "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake? I want a chocolate milkshake." The trip, the Confederate truck, the harassment from the guard, and now a request for a milkshake. This was becoming a bizarre day. I didn't hide my impatience. "No, Mr. Jenkins, I didn't bring you a chocolate milkshake. I'm an attorney. I'm here to help you with your case and to try to get you a new trial, okay? That's why I'm here. Now I need to ask you some questions and try to understand what's going on." I saw the grin fade quickly from the man's face. I started asking questions and he gave single-word answers, sometimes just grunting out a yes or no. I realized that he was still thinking about his milkshake. My frustration with the officer had made me forget how impaired this man might be. I stopped the interview and leaned forward. "Mr. Jenkins, I'm really sorry. I didn't realize you wanted me to bring you a chocolate milkshake. If I had known that, I would absolutely have tried. I promise that the next time I come, if they let me bring you in a chocolate milkshake, I'll definitely do it, okay?" With that, his smile returned and his mood brightened. He was generally kind and gentle in our meeting, but he was clearly ill. His prison records reveal that he often experienced psychotic episodes in which he would scream for hours. His trial records made no reference to mental illness. When I returned to my office, we began a deeper investigation into Mr. Jenkins' background. What we found was heartbreaking. His father had been murdered before he was born, and his mother had died of a drug overdose when he was a year old. He had been in foster care since he was 2 years old, and it had been horrific. 19 different foster homes before he turned 8. Many of the families that had taken him in were physically and sexually abusive. He began showing signs of intellectual disability at an early age. He had cognitive impairments that suggested some organic brain damage, and behavioral problems that suggested schizophrenia and other serious mental illness. By the time he was 13, he had started abusing drugs and alcohol. By 15, he was having seizures and experiencing psychotic episodes. At 17, he was left homeless. Avery was in and out of jail until he turned 20, when in the midst of a psychotic episode, he wandered into a strange house, thinking he was being attacked by demons. In the house, he brutally stabbed to death a man he believed to be a demon. His lawyers did no investigation of Mr. Jenkins' history prior to trial, and he was quickly convicted of murder and sentenced to death. The prison would not let me bring Mr. Jenkins a milkshake. I tried to explain this to him, but at the start of every visit, he'd ask me if I brought one. I promised that I would keep trying. I had to, just to get him to focus on anything else. Months later, we were finally scheduled to go to court to present the material that his lawyer should have presented at trial, evidence about his profound mental illness. Before the hearing started, I went to see Avery in the court's basement holding cell. After going through my usual protocol about the milkshake, I tried to get him to understand what would happen in court. I was concerned that seeing some of the witnesses, people who had dealt with him when he was in foster care, might upset him. Also, the testimony the experts would provide would be very direct in characterizing his disabilities and illness. I wanted him to understand why we were doing that. He was pleasant and agreeable, as always. Upstairs in the courtroom, I spotted the correctional officer who had given me such a hard time when I had first met Avery. I hadn't seen him since that initial ugly encounter. He must have been the officer assigned to transport Avery to the hearing. I'd asked another client about the guard and was told that he had a bad reputation. Most people tried to steer clear of him. Over the next 3 days, we presented our evidence about Avery's background. The medical experts who spoke about Avery's disabilities were terrific. They explained how organic brain damage, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder can create severe mental impairment. They explained that the psychosis and other serious mental health problems that Mr. Jenkins had could lead to dangerous behavior. This dangerous behavior stemmed from serious illness. It was not a reflection of his character. We also put forth evidence of how the foster care system had failed Avery. Several of the foster parents with whom Avery had been placed were later convicted of sexual abuse and criminal mismanagement of foster children. We discussed how Avery had been passed from one dangerous situation to the next until he was drug addicted and homeless. Several of Avery's former foster parents admitted to being very frustrated by him because they didn't know how to deal with his severe mental health problems. I argued to the judge that not taking Avery's mental health issues into consideration at trial was as cruel as saying to someone who had lost his legs, "You must climb these stairs with no assistance, and if you don't, you're just lazy." There are hundreds of ways we accommodate physical disabilities, or at least understand them. But because mental disabilities aren't visible in the same way, we tend to be dismissive of them and quick to judge. Brutally murdering someone would, of course, require the state to hold that person accountable and to protect the public. But to completely disregard a person's disability would be unfair in deciding what degree of culpability to assign and what sentence to impose. I went back home feeling very good about the hearing, but I wasn't expecting any miracle rulings. About a month after the hearing, before judgment was rendered, I decided to go to the prison and see if Avery was okay. When I pulled into the parking lot, I once again saw that loathsome truck with its flag, stickers, and gun rack. Sure enough, as I headed toward the visitation room, I saw the guard approaching me. I braced myself, preparing for the encounter, and then something surprising happened. "Hello, Mr. Stevenson, how are you?" the guard asked. He sounded earnest and sincere, and he wasn't glaring at me for once. I was skeptical, but I decided to play along. "Well, I'm fine. Look, I'll step into the bathroom to get ready for your search." "Oh, Mr. Stevenson, you don't have to worry about that," he quickly replied. "I know you're okay." Everything about his tone and demeanor was different. "Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'll go back and sign the book then." "Mr. Stevenson, you don't have to do that. I saw you coming and signed your name in for you. I've taken care of it." I realized that he actually looked nervous. Confused, I thanked him and walked to the visitation room door with the officer following behind me. He turned to unlock the padlock so that I could go inside. Before I could enter, he placed his hand on my shoulder. "Hey, I'd like to tell you something." I wasn't sure where he was going with this. "You know, I took old Avery to the court for his hearing and was down there with y'all for those 3 days. And, well, I want you to know that I was listening." He removed his hand from my shoulder and looked past me, as if staring at something behind me. "You know, I appreciate what you're doing. I really do. It was kind of difficult for me to be in that courtroom to hear what y'all was talking about. I came up in foster care, too. His face softened. Man, I didn't think anybody had it as bad as me. They moved me around like I wasn't wanted nowhere. I had it pretty rough. But listening to what you were saying about Avery made me realize that there were other people who had it as bad as I did. I guess even worse. I mean, it brought back a lot of memories sitting in that courtroom. He reached into his pocket to pull out a handkerchief to wipe perspiration from his brow. I noticed for the first time that he had a Confederate flag tattooed on his arm. You know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think it's good what you're doing. I got so angry coming up that there were plenty of times when I really wanted to hurt somebody just because I was angry. I made it to 18, joined the military, and you know, I've been okay, but sitting in that courtroom brought back memories, and I think I realized how I'm still kind of angry. I smiled. He continued. That expert doctor you put up said that some of the damage that's done to kids in these abusive homes is permanent. That kind of made me worry. You think that's true? Oh, I think we can always do better, I told him. The bad things that happen to us don't define us. It's just important sometimes that people understand where we're coming from. Another officer walked by and stared at us. I went on. You know, I really appreciate you saying to me what you just said. It means a lot. I really mean that. Sometimes I forget how we all need mitigation at some point. He looked at me and smiled. You kept talking about mitigation in that court. When I got home, I looked it up. I wasn't sure what you meant at first, but now I do. I think you done good, real good. He looked me in the eye before he extended his hand. We shook hands, and I started toward the door. I was just about inside when he grabbed my arm again. Oh, wait. I've got to tell you something else. Listen, I did something I probably wasn't supposed to do. On the trip back down here after court, well, I took him to a Wendy's, and I bought him a chocolate milkshake. I stared at him incredulously, and he broke into a chuckle. And then he left me inside the room. I was so stunned by what the officer said, I didn't hear the other officer bring Avery into the room. When I realized Avery was there, I turned and greeted him. When he didn't say anything, I was a little alarmed. Are you okay? Yes, sir, I'm fine. Are you okay? He asked. Yes, Avery, I'm really doing well. I waited for our ritual to begin. When he didn't say anything, I figured I'd just play my part. Look, I tried to bring you a chocolate milkshake, but they wouldn't. Avery cut me off. Oh, I got a milkshake. I'm okay now. As I began discussing the hearing, he grinned. We talked for an hour before I had to see another client. Avery never again asked me for a chocolate milkshake. We won a new trial for him and ultimately got him off death row and into a facility where he could receive mental health treatment. I never met the officer again. Someone told me he quit not long after that last time I saw him.
Chapter 11. I'll Fly Away. It was the third bomb threat in 2 months. As we quickly cleared the office and waited for the police to arrive, the entire EJI staff, 5 attorneys, an investigator, law school interns, and 3 administrative staff members were nervous. None of them had signed on for bomb threats. It was tempting to ignore them, but 2 years earlier, an African-American civil rights lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, named Robert Robbie Robinson, was murdered when a bomb sent to his law office exploded. Around the same time, a federal appeals court judge, Robert Vance, was killed in Birmingham by a mail bomb. Days later, a third bomb was sent to a civil rights office in Florida, and a fourth to a courthouse in Atlanta. The bomber seemed to be attacking legal professionals connected to civil rights. We were warned that we could be targets, and for weeks we carefully hauled our mail packages to the federal courthouse for X-ray screenings before opening them. After that, bomb threats were no joke. Everyone fled the building while we discussed the likelihood of an actual bombing. The caller had described our building precisely when making his threat.
Sharon, our receptionist, said the man had sounded middle-aged and southern, but she couldn't give any more of a description. It wasn't his first time calling.
"I'm doing you a favor," he said threateningly. "I want you all to stop doing what you're doing. My first option is not to kill everybody, so you better get out of there now. Next time there won't be a warning."
Although I was handling other cases, I was certain the calls were in response to the McMillan case. Michael and I had been followed several times while doing investigative work in Monroe County. I got threatening calls at home. One typical caller said,
"If you think we're going to let you help that lowlife get away with killing that girl, you've got another thing coming. You're both going to be dead."
It was hard to know how seriously to take any of it, but it was definitely unnerving. After we cleared the building, the police went through the office with dogs. No bomb was found, and when the building didn't blow up after an hour and a half, we all filed back inside. We had work to do. A few days later, a call came in from the clerk's office in Baldwin County. The clerk was calling to let me know that Judge Norton had ruled in the McMillan case. She needed my fax number to send me a copy of the ruling. I waited nervously by the fax machine. When only three sheets of paper came through the machine, I was concerned. The pages contained a tersely worded order from Judge Norton denying us relief. After all that, Walter's death penalty conviction remained. I had suspected that this would be Judge Norton's response. For all his interest at the hearing, he had never seemed particularly interested in the basic question of whether Walter was guilty or innocent. What was surprising, however, was how superficial and thoughtless the court's 2.5-page order read. The judge addressed only Ralph Myers' testimony and none of the many legal claims we'd presented or any of the testimonies of the other dozen-plus witnesses. I was disappointed, but not hopeless. There was a next step. We could bring our evidence to the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals. We were now regularly arguing cases in front of that court, and they were starting to respond to our advocacy. We had won 4 reversals in death penalty cases in 1990, 4 more in 1991, and by the end of 1992, we'd won relief for another 8 death row prisoners. Though the court was often resistant, we persisted and continued raising serious errors in capital cases. I was optimistic that we could win relief for Mr. McMillan on appeal. Even if the court was unwilling to rule that Walter was innocent and should be released, the withholding of exculpatory evidence, evidence in his favor, was extreme enough that the case would likely require a new trial. I explained to Walter that with the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals, we were only just now getting to a court where our claims would be seriously considered. At this time, Michael had been hired as a San Diego federal public defender. He agonized about leaving EJI, but he was ready to leave Alabama. One of our new attorneys, Bernard Harcourt, replaced him on Walter's case. Bernard was a lot like Michael in that he was smart, determined, and extremely hardworking. He had been preparing for a traditional legal career until he came down to work with us one summer and became fascinated by the issues that death penalty cases presented. He quickly immersed himself in Walter's case. The crowd at Walter's hearing got the community talking about what we had presented in court. More people started coming forward with helpful information and claims of police corruption and misconduct. Bernard and I continued to track leads and interview people in Monroe County. Not everyone was swayed by the hearing, though. Local Monroeville and Mobile newspapers printed claims that Walter was a drug kingpin, a sexual predator, and a gang leader. Despite all of the evidence presented at our hearing showing that Walter had nothing to do with the Pittman murder, the local press used it to scare up more fear about him. The narrative in the press was clear. This man was extremely dangerous. The threats we received made me worry about the hostility that Walter would face if he was ever released. I wondered how safely he could live locally if everyone outside his community was persuaded that he was a dangerous murderer. The case was now pending in the Court of Criminal Appeals. If the public could only know what we knew, it might ease his reentry into freedom. We wanted people to understand this simple fact. Walter did not commit that murder. Could some positive media attention help our case? I wasn't so sure. In fact, the chief judge on the court, John Patterson, had famously sued the New York Times over their coverage of the civil rights movement when he was Alabama's governor. It was a common tactic used by Southern politicians during civil rights protests. Accuse newspapers of trying to ruin their reputations, even sue them for defamation, if they provided sympathetic coverage of civil rights activists, or if they critiqued Southern politicians and law enforcement officers. I had no doubt that national press coverage of Walter's case would not help our cause at the Court of Criminal Appeals. My general attitude was that press coverage rarely helped our clients. Beyond the general anti-media sentiments in the South, the death penalty was a politically charged topic. Even sympathetic pieces about people on death row usually triggered a backlash that created more problems for the client and the case. But I did think getting a more informed view of Walter's conviction and the murder would convince some locals that he was innocent, and assuming we could ever get his conviction overturned, make his life after release less dangerous. It was risky, but we felt that we had to take our chances and get the story out. Journalist Pete Early jumped into the case, spent time with several of the involved individuals, and quickly came to share our astonishment that Walter had been convicted on such unreliable evidence. That year, I'd given a speech at Yale Law School that was attended by a producer from the popular CBS investigative program, 60 Minutes. He also called me. We filed our appeal in the Court of Criminal Appeals that summer, and with no small amount of lingering uncertainty, I decided to move forward with the 60 Minutes piece. Veteran reporter Ed Bradley and his producer David Gelber came down from New York City to Monroeville on a 100-degree day in July and interviewed many of the people whose testimony we'd presented at our hearing. They spoke with Walter, Ralph Myers, Karen Kelly, Darnell Houston, Clay Cast, Jimmy Williams, Walter's family, and Woodrow Eichner. They confronted Bill Hooks at his job and interviewed Tommy Chapman extensively. When the 60 Minutes piece aired months later, local officials and local media outlets were quick to discredit it, claiming that it was further injuring Rhonda Morrison's parents. Writers at local newspapers complained that the new publicity could lead many people to think McMillan is innocent. But people in the community watched 60 Minutes all the time and generally trusted it. Despite the local media reaction, the CBS coverage gave the community a summary of the evidence we presented in court and created questions and doubts about Walter's guilt. People in the black community, who had been discussing Walter's wrongful conviction for years, were thrilled to see honest coverage of the case. We frequently got calls from people simply seeking an update or a clarification of a particular point that had been the subject of debate in a barbershop or at a social gathering. For many black people in the region, watching the evidence that we had presented in court, now laid out on national television, was therapeutic. It turned out that privately, District Attorney Tom Chapman had started worrying about the reliability of the evidence against Walter. Given our success in other death penalty cases, he must have feared that the court might indeed overturn Walter's conviction. Chapman had become the public face defending the conviction, and he realized that he'd put his own integrity on the line by relying on the work of local investigators, work that was now revealed as almost laughably flawed. Chapman called together Tate, Larry Eichner, and Benson shortly after the hearing to ask them to explain the contradictory evidence we had presented. He wasn't impressed with what he heard. Finally, he decided to ask ABI officials in Montgomery to re-examine the evidence and conduct another investigation into the murder to confirm Mr. McMillan's guilt, something we'd been asking him to do for more than 2 years. Chapman never told us directly that he was starting another investigation. We found out about it when the new investigators from the ABI, Tom Taylor and Greg Cole, called me. After meeting with them, I was even more hopeful about what might come out of the investigation. They were not connected to any of the players in South Alabama. They both seemed no-nonsense, experienced, and interested in doing honest and reliable work. We gave them all our case files and evidence. We had nothing to hide. I was confident that any reasonable, honest investigation would reveal the absurdity of the charges against Walter. By January, 6 months had passed since we had filed our appeal at the Court of Criminal Appeals, and a ruling was due any week. That's when Tom Taylor called and said that he and Cole wanted to meet with us again. We'd talked a few times during their investigation, but this time we'd finally be discussing their findings. When they arrived, Bernard and I sat down with them in my office, and they wasted no time. "There is no way Walter McMillan killed Rhonda Morrison." Tom Taylor spoke plainly and directly. "We're going to report to the Attorney General, the District Attorney, and anyone who asks that McMillan had nothing to do with either of these murders and is completely innocent." I tried not to look as thrilled as I felt. I didn't want to scare away this good news. "That's terrific," I said, trying to sound unsurprised. "I'm pleased to hear that, and I have to say I'm extremely grateful that you've looked at the evidence in this case thoroughly and honestly." "Well, confirming that McMillan had nothing to do with this wasn't that hard," Taylor replied. "What we were told by local law enforcement about McMillan didn't make much sense, and the story Myers told at trial definitely made no sense. I still can't believe a jury ever convicted him." Cole spoke up. "You'll be very interested to know that both Hooks and Hightower have admitted that their trial testimony was false." "Really?" I couldn't hide my surprise at this. "Yes. When we were asked to investigate this case, we were told that you should be investigated because Hooks had said that you had offered him money and a condo in Mexico if he changed his testimony." Taylor was dead serious. "A condo in Mexico? On a beach, I think," Cole added nonchalantly. "Wait, me? I was going to give Bill Hooks a beach condo in Mexico if he changed his testimony against Walter?" It was difficult to contain my shock. "Well, I know it must sound crazy to you, but believe me, there were people down there who were raring to get you indicted. But when we talked to Hooks, it didn't take very long before he not only acknowledged that he'd never spoken to you and that you had never bribed him, but he also admitted that his trial testimony against McMillan was completely made up." "We've never had any doubts that Hooks was lying," I noted. Cole chuckled. "We started polygraphing people, and things fell apart pretty quickly." Bernard asked the obvious question. "What happens now?" Taylor looked over at his partner and then at us. "Well, we're not completely done. We'd like to solve this crime. I'm wondering if you might be willing to help us. I know you're not trying to get anybody on death row, but we thought you might consider providing some help to identify the real killer. People will be a lot more accepting of Mr. McMillan's innocence if they know who really committed this crime." While it was ridiculous to think that Walter's freedom depended on someone else's arrest, we had long ago concluded that finding the real murderer might be the most effective way to free him. Without law enforcement officers on our side, though, we were limited in what we could uncover. Here's what we had so far. Several witnesses had told us that around the time of the crime, they'd seen a white man leaving the cleaners. We had learned that before her death, Rhonda Morrison had been receiving menacing calls, and that there was a man who had been inappropriately pursuing her, stopping by unannounced at the cleaners, maybe even stalking her. We had not been able to identify this strange man, but we did have our suspicions. A white man who seemed intensely interested in the case contacted us frequently to ask about the investigation. He would hint at having information that could help, and repeatedly told us he would help prove that Walter McMillan was innocent. He even claimed to know where the murder weapon, which had never been recovered, might be located. We researched the caller's background and discovered a history of stalking, violence against women, and preoccupation with the Morrison murder. We began to think that our caller could be the person who had murdered Rhonda Morrison. We had dozens of phone conversations with him and even met him a couple of times. Once we asked him direct questions about where he was on the day of the murder, which must have alarmed him, because we heard from him less often after that. Before I could tell any of this to the ABI investigators, Taylor named our suspect. I told Taylor to give us a few days to organize the information and recordings of phone calls, and then we would turn it over. "We want to get Walter out of prison as soon as possible," I insisted. "Well, I think the Attorney General and the lawyers would like to maintain the status quo for a few more months, until we can make an arrest of the actual killer."
"Right, but you do understand that the status quo is a problem for us. Walter has been on death row for nearly 6 years for a crime he didn't commit."
Taylor and Cole looked at each other uncomfortably. Taylor admitted,
"If I was in prison for something I didn't do, and you were my lawyer, I hope you'd get me out as soon as you could."
When they left, Bernard and I were very excited, but we remained troubled by this plan to maintain the status quo. I was furious that the state would try to prolong any order granting relief to Walter. It was consistent with everything that had happened over the last 6 years, but it was still maddening. We told the court that there was overwhelming evidence that Mr. McMillan's rights had been violated, and that he was entitled to immediate relief. Delaying relief would add further injury to a man who had been wrongfully convicted and condemned to death row for a crime he did not commit. I was talking to Minnie and the family every week now, keeping everyone updated about the new state investigation.
"I feel like something good is about to happen, Brian," Minnie said to me. "They've kept him for years. Now it's time they let him go. They have to let him go."
I appreciated her optimism, but I worried, too. We'd been disappointed so often before. Managing the family's expectations was a complex task. I felt I was supposed to be the cautionary voice that prepared family members for the worst, even while I urged them to hope for the best. Increasingly, I was recognizing the importance of hopefulness in creating justice. On February 23, nearly 6 weeks after getting the ABI's report, I received a call from the clerk of the court. The Court of Criminal Appeals had ruled in the McMillan case, and we could pick up the opinion.
"You're going to like this," she said mysteriously.
I ran to the courthouse. By the time I sat down to read the 35-page ruling, I was out of breath. The clerk was right. The ruling invalidated Walter's conviction and death sentence. The court didn't conclude that he was innocent and must be released, but it ruled in our favor on every other claim and ordered a new trial. I didn't realize how much I had feared that we would lose until we finally won. I jumped into the car and raced down to death row to tell Walter in person. I watched him take it all in. He leaned back and gave me a familiar chuckle.
"Well," he said slowly, "you know, that's good. That's good."
"Good? It's great."
"Yeah, it is great."
He was grinning now with a freedom I hadn't seen before.
"Whew, man, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Whew."
His smile started to fade, and he began slowly shaking his head.
6 years. 6 years gone.
He looked away with a pained expression.
"These 6 years feel like 50. 6 years, just gone. I've been so worried they were going to kill me, I haven't even thought about the time I've lost."
His troubled look sobered me, too. "I know, Walter, and we're not clear yet," I said. "The ruling only gives you a new trial. Given what the ABI has said, I can't believe they would try to prosecute you again. But with this crowd, reasonable conduct is never guaranteed. I'm going to try and get you home as soon as humanly possible." With thoughts of home, his mood lightened, and we started talking about things we'd been too afraid to discuss since we'd met. He said,
"I want to meet everybody who has helped me in Montgomery, and I want to go around with you and tell the world what they did to me. There are other people here who are as innocent as I am."
He paused and started smiling again.
"Man, I want some good food, too. I ain't had no real good food in so long I can't even remember what it tastes like."
"Whatever you want, it will be my treat," I said proudly.
"From what I hear, you might not be able to afford the kind of meal I want," he teased. "I want steak, chicken, pork, and maybe some good cooked coon."
We relaxed and laughed a lot.
We had laughed before that. Walter's sense of humor hadn't failed him despite his 6 years on death row. But the laughter that day felt very different. It was the laughter of liberation. I drove back to Montgomery and thought about how to speed up Walter's release. I called Tommy Chapman and told him that I intended to file a motion to dismiss all charges against Walter in light of the appellate court ruling. I asked if he would consider joining the motion, or at least not opposing it. He sighed. I'll get back to you about whether I'll join it. We certainly won't oppose it. The state did, in fact, join our motion to dismiss the charges. A final hearing on the motion was set, and it wouldn't last more than a few minutes. Walter would finally be able to walk out of the courthouse a free man. The night before the hearing, I drove down to Minnie's to get a suit for Walter to wear to the courthouse. When I arrived at her house, she gave me a long hug. It looked like she had been crying and hadn't slept. We sat down and she told me again how happy she was that they were letting him out. But she looked troubled. Finally, she turned to me. "Brian, I think you need to tell him that maybe he shouldn't come back here. It's just all been too much. The stress, the gossip, the lies, everything. He doesn't deserve what they put him through, and it will hurt me to my heart the rest of my life what they did to him and the rest of us. But I don't think I can go back to the way things were." "Well, you all should talk when he gets home. We want to have everybody over when he gets out. We want to cook some good food, and everybody will want to celebrate. But after that, maybe he should go to Montgomery with you," she said. I had already talked with Walter about not staying his first few nights in Monroeville for security reasons. We had talked about him spending time with family members in Florida while we monitored the local reaction to his release, but I hadn't discussed his future with Minnie. I drove back to Montgomery, sadly realizing that even as we stood on the brink of victory and what should have been a glorious release for Walter and his family, this whole nightmare, the conviction, the death sentence, and the heartbreak and devastation of this miscarriage of justice would likely never be completely over for him. State, local, and national media outlets were crowded outside the courthouse when I arrived the next morning. Dozens of Walter's family members and friends from the community were there to greet him when he came out. They had made signs and banners which surprised me. They were such simple gestures, but I found myself deeply moved. The signs gave a silent voice to the crowd. "Welcome home, Johnny D. God never fails. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." I went down to the jail and brought Walter his suit. I told him that a celebration was planned at his house after the hearing. The prison had not allowed Walter to bring his possessions to the courthouse, refusing to acknowledge that he might be released, so we would have to go back to Holman Prison to get his things before the homecoming meal. I also told him that I'd reserved a hotel room for him in Montgomery, and that it would probably be safest to spend the next few nights there. I reluctantly talked to him about my conversation with Minnie. He seemed surprised and hurt, but didn't linger on it. "This is really a happy day for me. Nothing can really spoil getting your freedom back." "Well, y'all should talk at some point," I urged. I went upstairs to find Tommy Chapman waiting for me in the courtroom. "After we're done, I'd like to shake his hand," he told me. "Would that be all right?" "I think he'd appreciate that," I said. "This case has taught me things I didn't even know I had to learn," Chapman said. "We've all learned a lot, Tommy." Everyone was strangely pleasant. Judge Norton had retired weeks before the ruling, and the new judge, Pamela Bishab, greeted me warmly. "Mr. Stevenson, I don't need any arguments or statements. I intend to grant the motion immediately so y'all can get home. We can get this done quickly," she said. There was no metal detector, no menacing dog. The courtroom was packed with Walter's family members and supporters. There were more cheering black folks outside the courthouse who couldn't get in. A horde of television cameras and journalists spilled out of the crowded courtroom. They finally brought Walter into the courtroom, wearing the black suit and white shirt I'd brought him. The deputies didn't handcuff Walter or shackle him, so he walked in waving to family and friends. Many in the crowd gasped. His family had not seen him dressed in anything but his white prison uniform in 6 years. He looked handsome and fit, like a different man. The judge took the bench and I stepped forward to speak. I gave a brief history of the case and informed the court that both the defendant and the state were moving the court to dismiss all charges. The judge quickly granted the motion and asked if there was anything further. Everyone was suddenly generous and accommodating. It was as if they wanted to be sure there were no hard feelings or grudges. I felt strangely agitated. We were about to leave court for the last time, and I started thinking about how much pain and suffering had been inflicted on Walter, his family, the entire community. I thought about how, if Judge Robert E. Lee Key, Jr. hadn't overridden the jury's verdict of life imprisonment without parole and imposed the death penalty, which is what brought the case to our attention, Walter likely would have spent the rest of his life incarcerated and died in a prison cell. I thought about how certain it was that hundreds, maybe thousands of other people were just as innocent as Walter, but would never get the help they need. I knew this wasn't the time to make a speech, but I couldn't stop myself from making one final comment. Your Honor, I spoke up. I just want to say this before we adjourn. It was far too easy to convict this wrongly accused man for murder and send him to death row for something he didn't do, and much too hard to win his freedom after proving his innocence. We have serious problems and important work that must be done in this state. I sat down, and the judge pronounced Walter free to go. Just like that, he was a free man. Walter hugged me tightly. I gave him a handkerchief to wipe the tears from his eyes. Graciously, Walter agreed to shake Chapman's hand. I asked Bernard to tell the family and supporters that we would meet them out front. Walter stood very close to me as we answered questions from the press. I could tell he was feeling overwhelmed, so I cut off the questions after a few minutes. TV camera crews followed us as we exited the courthouse. Outside, dozens of people cheered and waved their signs. Walter's relatives ran up to hug him, and they hugged me, too. Walter's grandchildren grabbed his hands. Walter couldn't believe how many people were there for him. Even when some of the men came up to shake his hand, he gave them a hug. I told everyone that Bernard and I had to take Walter to the prison to pick up his things, and that we would come to the house directly from there. On the drive to the prison, Walter told me that the men on death row had held a special service for him on his last night. They had come to pray for him and give him their final hugs. Walter said he felt guilty leaving them behind. I told him not to. They were all thrilled to know he was going home. His freedom was, in a small way, a sign of hope in a hopeless place. We went to the prison office to collect Walter's possessions, his legal materials and correspondence with me, letters from family and supporters, a Bible, the Timex watch he was wearing when he was arrested, and the wallet he had had with him back in June 1987 when his nightmare began. The wallet still had $23 in it. Walter had given to other death row prisoners his fan, a dictionary, and the food items he had in his cell. A few guards watched as we walked out the front gate of the prison. Members of the press and people from Walter's family and community had followed our car to the prison. Lots of people were gathered outside. I saw Mrs. Williams. Walter went up to her and gave her a hug. She looked over and winked at me. I couldn't help but laugh. Men in their cells could see the crowd outside and started shouting encouragement to Walter as he walked away. We couldn't see them from outside the prison, but their voices rang out just the same. The voices were haunting because they were disembodied, but they were full of excitement and hopefulness. One of the last voices we heard was a man shouting, "Stay strong, man, stay strong." Walter shouted back, "All right." As he walked to the car, Walter raised his arms and gently moved them up and down as if he meant to take flight. He looked at me and said, "I feel like a bird. I feel like a bird."
Chapter 12. Mother, Mother. Marcia Colby and her husband Glenn may have been poor, but they always gave their family all of their love. A white woman from a rural Alabama town, 43-year-old Marcia already had 6 kids when she discovered she was pregnant with a 7th. Marcia knew that a pregnancy at her age was very risky, but she couldn't